Welcome to the Business of Watches, where horology meets high finance and each tick tells a story of markets, margins, mishaps, and mechanical mastery. I'm your host, Andy Hoffman, Senior Business Editor at Hodinkee. In this series, we dive deep into the global watch industry, a place where centuries-old craftsmanship intersects with billion-dollar valuations, executive brand strategy, and investor speculation. From Swiss valleys to Silicon Valley, we trace the movements shaping this uniquely resilient sector. Just how big is the business of timekeeping? Well, some estimates place the entire watch industry, from ultra-luxury maisons to smartwatches and micro-brands, at north of $100 billion globally. But behind that figure is a complex web of legacy, innovation, and ever-shifting consumer tastes and demand. This is the podcast for collectors, analysts, watch buyers and sellers, and anyone who's fascinated by the intersection of wristwear and wealth. Because if time is money, then money is most certainly time. So let's get down to business. It's hard to think of a watch brand more international in its origins and ownership history than Frederic Constant. The value and volume-focused Swiss-based mark was started by a couple from the Netherlands while they lived in Hong Kong, and today it's owned by Japan's Citizen Group. A stalwart among European watch consumers looking for a balance of price, quality, and classic design, Frederic Constant is ranked among the 50 largest Swiss brands by Morgan Stanley and Lux Consult. And now it's looking to boost its presence in North America, especially the U.S. Running the show is Niels Eggerding, a Dutchman who has been with the brand since 2012 and in the managing director or CEO chair since 2018. There are a lot of moving parts with this brand at the moment, from the challenge of keeping the price of its perpetual calendar below 10,000 euros to sustaining demand and production of its low-price models that account for more than 90% of its volumes, and they allow the brand to keep pushing the envelope with high horology at approachable prices. And finally, growing the U.S. business at a time when tariffs are making the country hostile to Swiss watchmakers. Here's our conversation with Frederic Constant CEO, Niels Eggerding. We're here with Niels Eggerding, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Frederic Constant. Yeah. You also oversee Alpina.
Yes.
As well. Thank you for joining the podcast.
I'm super happy to be with you, Andy.
Excellent. Excellent. So, you know, let's start with where we are. We're more than halfway through 2025. It's been a challenging year. A lot has gone on. There's been a lot happening. Tell me, you know, where Frederic Constant is at and what you're doing in this market.
Yeah, so I think a brand like Frederic Constant, we have been, I always say that the brand has the diversity to act in multiple ranges because we do manufacture, but we also do a lot of volume. But manufacture is the biggest speaking and loudness of our storytelling, but it's only 7% of our volume.
How much percent?
7% of the
volume. 7%.
So,
wow.
But it's high value.
Yeah.
But we still do a lot of volume in the manufacture. So we do like 3,500 wheel timers a year. And that's just one movement we have. But 93% is volume.
Yep.
And in the past years after COVID, we cannot neglect the fact that the hype was high-end. And we could lift on this hype. We did Tourbillon, we did the perpetual calendar Tourbillon, we did exclusive world timers, we launched several new movements, and we really seen the success of that.
Yep.
But what you don't see with that is your margin, because it's an expensive production line for us. And because we are accessible in price with that, we don't have a lot of margin there. We need the volume to basically reinvest back into innovations on manufacture. And I'm very happy that last year the volume picked up. And
interesting.
We are ahead of the game for me. We have invested a lot of noise, distribution, everything is well set. And for me, it's just a matter of now turning the machine
right
on the right way.
Let's talk about the history of Frère Constant. It has some history, it has some heritage, not quite as much as some of the other Swiss brands. But, you know, you've been here around 13 years and you've been in the CEO job for about 8 years. But what is the history of Frère Constant as a Swiss watchmaker?
It all started, I'm talking about 37 years ago, by a Dutch couple, Peter and Aletta Stas, the founders of the brand. They were expatriate in Hong Kong, and they always had a passion for watchmaking. They were traveling back from ski holiday up and down to Switzerland, looking at windows at retailers, seeing the brands like Vacheron, Jaeger LeCoultre. Loved the brands, but as a Dutch, you don't want to expand so much, right? So they came up with the idea, why don't we make a watch that has the same look, but is much more accessible in price? And they started to work on the kitchen table back in Hong Kong, because Peter was working for Philips as a marketing director for products. And Aletta was doing legal for ING, the Dutch bank. And they were really doing it on the side. And they created some samples going back and forth. Took them a year, and they went to a Hong Kong-based show where Swiss watch brands, Hong Kong-based brands, China brands were selling Japanese brands. And a Japanese distributor was super interested. And they were the first one placing an order of 300 pieces. And there it all started. So they produced, of course, with not having suppliers, not having movements, nothing. So it took them 2 years to produce. The moment they shipped the watch, it was sold in 1 week, and they placed an order of 3,000 pieces. So for them, the idea of having a watch brand and seeing the success was one, but feeling the success was number two. And they felt it, and they went into, okay, this is a hit. We can continue now. And from there, it really started. And it built to a brand now after 37 years. I would say we are no longer adolescents.
Yeah.
We are major, we are senior, but we are far from the big ones that are existing for 200 years. But still yet, we are in the top 37 watch brands in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite an achievement, I would say, for a young couple in that time.
And Frère Constant and Alpina are part of the Citizen Group, owned by Citizen of Japan. What's the history of that acquisition? When did it happen? And what role does, you know, Citizen, a big giant watchmaking company, play in the brand now?
Well, it all started back in 2016. It took 1 year of discussions in that time with Peter and Aletta, and they really wanted to have their feet into the Swiss business with a luxury brand, although close to volume. So there's a few options. And Frère Constant is, of course, a serious option because they had the manufacturing complication. And Peter and Aletta were very happy to have the acquisition happened by Citizen because value-wise, it's very similar.
Mm.
Although you can say it's much more volume than luxury, it's Japanese versus a Swiss company. Keep in mind that the Japanese and the Dutch culture are very conflictual. Japanese are not direct, Dutch are very direct. So it has been a marriage, I would say, a bit complicated in the beginning. But the strength of Citizen has been industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
They purchased Le Jouperet.
Yes.
A Swiss manufacturer in the center of Switzerland, La Chaux-de-Fonds. They have massive affiliates in the world where America is basically Citizen. You could say Citizen is the number two watch brand in the US. Mm. And Rolex.
Yeah.
So what is an achievement? The team there has done a remarkable job. And we had difficulties to build distribution, in particular the countries where Citizen was strong. And from day one, that has been a strong focus. How can we merge the brand into those affiliates? UK, Italy, Japan, China, US, Canada, Mexico, all strong companies, strong countries. Mexico, think about Mexico, how potential that is.
Sure.
US, huge potential. UK, Italy, one of the leading markets from Europe. So we really had the entry there on strong distribution.
So Citizen owns many other brands, many other manufacturers. You know, they own La Jouperet here now. What interaction is there? Is there any connection with what La Jouperet is doing and what Frédéric Constant is doing here in Switzerland?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think I think Le Jeu Perret has been a raw diamond too in the past years and shown that they have capabilities of strong innovative drive. So they have brought their G100 movement, they have their L100 movement, they do all the modifications on movements, they do tourbillon, they do finishing, they work with all the big brands. On top of that, they really decided strategically to build together in that time with the LV Image Group and solar quartz movement.
Right.
And recently we have been able to launch it also in our brands. So okay. Alpina is the first one where we have access to that caliber. And for us, that's exactly what we needed. A volume-driven, sustainable movement that is, of course, with the heritage of Citizen, a Swiss-made movement with that know-how in Swiss-made has been for us and strategic move.
Interesting. And do we see, there we see it with the new solar quartz movement, and you're using that in Alpina. Do we see La Jeu Perret movements in Frédéric Constant? Do we see,
So definitely the G100 is one of their, in between a base caliber we have, automatic, where we still work also with Sellita, for instance, that we do large volumes in, 995, 1295, 1495 range. Mm-hmm. And Le Jeu Perret, the G100, is more in a luxury, I would say, the Première collection. It's just below 2,000 euro, US slightly above, but highly finished. It's a very qualitative movement, 68-hour power reserve, nicely decorated. And you can see that it's really a competitive move and a competitive movement. So definitely you will see more to come in the future.
And, you know, when I first met you, it was probably back in 2022, and I was at Bloomberg and you were here, and it was a different time for the watch industry. And you were talking a lot about, you know, moving up in price and moving up in complications and the kind of watches that Frédéric Constant can do and can make and can compete in with the rest of the market. You know, it's a different time now. Where are we in the strategy and in the watches that you're focusing on for your customers at this point?
So I can bring you over a bit of range, what we are doing, but I think it's more important to understand that how our collection is built. Number one is manufacturer collection. Starting price around $3,000-$3,500 US. And then you go to the classics, 60-70% of our business. And then you have High Life. High Life is integrated bracelet, a little bit more sport chic. It was a collection that we created back in 2019 to launch in 20, because we were very classical as a brand and the trend in that time was less classic.
Right.
And we missed opportunity to engage with a new audience. So High Life was definitely a new audience for us. And it nicely integrated into the collection. The biggest storytelling we do is manufacture. Although it's 7% of the volume, it's 20-25% of the value we are doing. Mm-hmm. And it's 50-60% of the storytelling.
Right.
Then if you go to movements, we start the collection of 795 euro, let's say 850 US dollar. I don't know exactly the rates, but let's say 850, that's quartz. Then you go above 1,000, you go to solar quartz now. Then around 1,000, you have a base Sellita movement that goes all the way up with Le Jeu Perret to 2,500 euro. Mm-hmm. We have Chrono, Sellita, or Le Jeu Perret around 3,500 euro. And that's where the manufacture collection starts.
I see.
And the manufacture collection has always been unique for us because we do it industrialization on the manufacture calibers. And we are the only one who's capable of doing it in our price range. There's right. no competition who's able to do what we are doing in that price range. You can debate that certain brands are doing small batches themselves. Multiple brands are doing it external. We really do it internal. So we have CNC machines, T0, we have T1, where the assembling of movements takes place. Of course, now with Le Jeu Perret, it's an interesting move because we can collaborate much more with each other. How can we optimize even? How can we bring efficiency in there? But manufacture has been for us a strong innovative push to tell the story and to differentiate compared to the competition.
You make a perpetual calendar
yes.
that last time I checked was around 10,000 francs, around $10,000. I mean, that was a real achievement, I think, you know, for the brand. And talk about the process to develop that and to make that happen. And then what you're doing now to keep that price there, because it's not easy.
That's not an easy one. I have to say it's also not an easy one to protect those prices against my shareholding company, because of course they want to see profit and they want to see margin. But on the other hand, we also want to stay true to our DNA, and that's let more people enjoy luxury. That's the mission we have. 2016, we launched for the first time Perpetual Calendar. 3 years of development. And the beautiful part of that is it has been designed based on a 42 millimeter case design in that time, where the dial is quite spread, where the competition, you had multiple brands who were doing a Perpetual Calendar, but they were very narrowed designed. So the counters were very close to the center. And we designed first the dial, the watch, and based on this, we designed the movement. In that time, the Calibre was launched for 8,000 euro, 7,995. It was a hit. So all the years after, we have been working with different movements, upgrading movements. And 2 years ago, we started with an upgrade of Power Reserve, because the base we have of Manufacture has 38 to 42 hour Power Reserve. And we really wanted to go to a weekender. We call that the weekender. You put it away, your dress watch on Friday, you pick it up on Monday, it still runs. So 72-hour Power Reserve needs to be in place. So that update took place 2 years ago. We launched last year in the base of our Manufacture Calibre, Point of Date, Moon Phase. And this year we launched it at a Perpetual Calendar. But I wanted no longer a 42 millimeter case. I wanted a 40 millimeter case.
Yep.
So 96 to 97% of the components of the movements are the same. So also after sales, quality, it's all important to stay close to that. But we didn't want to go over 10,000 euro. The problem was, if you only look in 10 years time on the index of the value of money, it would have been already going over 10,000.
Yes, so you've had to work.
Work on it. Yeah. We also had to accept less margin, but I want to keep it accessible, especially in the time we're living, where all the brands have been going up with price aggressively, in some extent even priced themselves completely outside their DNA, what is very dangerous, because the customers one day is noticing it and they don't appreciate it anymore. So we felt it's the right moment to make a punch to the competition, but also to the consumer, to give them really value for the money.
Interesting.
And that's where we positioned it below the 10,000 euro.
Yes. And what is the biggest, well, I presume for the US market, tariffs are now certainly the pressure point there. But yeah, what is the major pressure points for keeping it? Or is it simply a matter of, you know, reducing your margin?
To keep it very simple, it's mostly reducing margins, because supply has been going up, labor cost has been going up. You need to think about the industrialization we have in place for QP. It's less industrialized, although it needs to be qualified for us for industrialization. But we don't produce thousands of pieces. It's around, I would say, we blocked it in the production capacity to 750 pieces per year. That are sold out, by the way. That's just to give you a visualization. But it's really taking less margin on this piece.
And I think Morgan Stanley estimates you make about 60,000 watches per year, and your revenue's around a little more than 100 million. I mean, what should we think of that estimate?
So they're quite accurate in the variations of it, but I cannot disclose numbers, but they're very low with volume.
Understood.
They're very low with the volume.
Okay.
Yeah. And significant low.
When we think about distribution and how people find your watches and buy your watches, what's been the evolution of that? We see Frederic Constant a lot at retailers. How has that changed, and what kind of retailers are you working with these days?
It depends a bit. In the US, for instance, US is a continent, correct? It's no longer a country considered for me. It's so big. It's right. The size of Europe. And if you look at Europe, only Europe, we have close to 1,000 retailers.
Right.
So, and I think the US has around 400 retail. Knowing that the machine we have running there with Citizen behind it, they have so much manpower. We can easily go to 500-600 retail there, I would say. But there's much more the approach of segmentation. So not all retail is willing to sell a world timer or is willing to sell a QP. They don't have the brand environment. So are we going to say no with our volume to retail that can sell volume? No, I would say no. You should reward them. Because today for retail, it's very difficult to get brands. Yeah. And we are a perfect example where it can fit into both worlds. So it has always been this way, but we are more focused on the volume, I would say.
When I think of direct to consumer, I mean, how much has that become part of your business or you know, I presume it's...
Well, the consumer has become very important. I think many brands, they made mistakes in the past years where they were just deciding what to do, hoping that the retail or the consumer will pick it up. In today's world, if you don't listen to your consumer or your retail, you lose it. Because they're so knowledgeable. They are the ones who need to follow your brand or not. They are the ones who are buying your product or not. So if you think you can just produce whatever you produce and they will pick it up, you're wrong. So for me, it has been very important to create that customer experience, but also have a lot of, let's say, video content. Mm. And I'm always reading myself feedback about what we launch. And we have a solution where we can see every watch is sold. Today, data is the new money in a way. And it's for me very important to follow by reporting what kind of profile today is buying our watch. And that we can see via Dentsu solution, where we have instant insight about where the watch is sold, what store, and what kind of profile. And that's very important. And what I can see in this, because that's probably your next question, is that we became attracted for more women than expected.
Hmm.
And younger audience, so the two. And that's exactly what we wanted. Younger audience was really one of the aims we had 6-7 years ago. And women has become a major opportunity for the brand because there are many brands who are producing woman watches or female feminine watches. But it's not about diamonds. It's not about a pink watch. There's much more to do for women. And I find that women are cornered a bit. They're almost forced to buy masculine watches to be fulfilled with what they want. So it's a lot of attention and I would say a lot of eye for detail to jump in that segment and to penetrate the market. But we are absolutely doing very well there.
Interesting. Can you talk about any way to quantify how big your, you know, customer base of women is, how much it's grown?
I can tell you a bit of a direction that I've been seeing in the US. It's almost 50-50. Yeah? Yeah,
wow.
It's very big.
Interesting.
And the latest launch we have been doing that came to birth last year, it was really based on vintage look. We were looking with the team, what is now attracted by women? And you could see in that time the trend of that bracelet design of watch that was very popular. And if you then look at that, who is doing it now accessible? There was zero.
Right.
So for us, we just looked at the archives we had. 20 years ago, we had like a bracelet design watch, the manchette, and we just redone it completely in a modern way with stone dials, but also with diamond setting. And it's a huge hit. In the past 13 years, yeah. I've never seen such a hit for women collection. Because women watches are very complicated.
So this watch you're talking about, I mean, it's basically, you know, a tank style.
No, it's not a tank style. It's really one bracelet.
Like a cuff.
Like a cuff. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like a bracelet with a watch in it, integrated. And it really is a perfect match. And it sells very easily.
And, you know, you talked to, in this case, you were able to access a sort of heritage design,
yeah.
I mean, heritage for
such
for
a young brand,
Crownstone, indeed, which is interesting. even you are able at this point to go back to your archives. But how nimble can you be? I mean, would you agree, a few years ago, everybody was talking about sports watches, and
yeah.
so you created the High Life line. But would you agree we've moved, you know, back towards smaller watches, more shaped kind of watches, classic watches, and how nimble can you be in terms of your product and design?
For us, the strength of my company and my team has been the speed of working. It has been on the pressure because we became very corporate also. We are part of a big group. You have to report. You have to discuss on strategy. You have to engage on product development. So it brought down a bit the speed. But in some extent, I would say the Japanese company are keeping us very independent. So they know that the advantage is speed.
Hmm.
And I think it's very important for a watch brand. The moment you feel you miss something and there's a trend that follows your DNA, you need to go quick. And that's specifically also that bracelet design. We have Carré watches that are popular. You have to develop. You have to be quick with development. And you should not leave it down for 16 months. You should really narrow it down to 9 to 12 months. Well, it's not easy, yeah? It's a big pressure for the team, I can tell you.
Yeah, it's very difficult to be reactive and quick in watchmaking simply because of the manufacturing process. I mean, how involved is the corporate parent citizen in terms of, you know, design, strategic direction? They've been the owner for a while, but yeah, I mean, how involved are they?
I would say they're heavily involved. I would say 5 years ago, it was less, but if you really want to make a difference in the industry, you need to collaborate stronger as with a big group behind you, especially after the difficult times we have been going through. But also key markets like the US, you should really have an engagement with them. The big mistakes that many Swiss brands are doing is that they just put a Swiss guy in the US and they believe he will run the show there. Now, forget it. It's never been successful. Look at many brands, big groups who did that. You really need someone who knows, he comes from there, from the US, who knows the language. And I'm not speaking about language, but really understanding and knows how to penetrate the market. And definitely we have a team there that knows everything. So they're very capable. But by collaborating together, listening to what they need, answering and strategize that together with the mother company, that's the strength. And then the moment you have an agreement and an engagement with all together, you go. And that execution can go quick.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, it is now the biggest single country watch market in the world, and it is incredibly important. It's also incredibly challenging right now. Can you talk
with the tarif?
Indeed.
Yeah, I know.
Can you talk a bit about how your regional distribution or your regional sort of markets have changed over the years? Because indeed, I mean, you know, Europe has long been sort of a key market for Frédéric Constant. Yeah. But yeah, how has that evolved?
Europe is continuing to go strong. Less growth. So you cannot expect double-digit growth every year because it's a really mature market. But it still goes strong. And I would say we have always been very European-driven as a brand. That's where I think with the US, so if you look at Europe strong, continuing to be strong, that's the trick with the US. If you stay too strong in your European DNA, you miss the boat. And that's where the collaboration is important. They need to have input. What do you need for the US? Where is the need of the consumer and what do they like and what do we need to answer? Now, that has been very important. And we did that in the past years together with the help of the US team. And we have seen a major growth happening. And we are just in the beginning of this, I can tell you. So tarif or no tarif, I'm not concerned about that. We will find solutions. I also find that many brands are super nervous and anxious about it. Kind of agree with that. But you cannot control. So we can debate for hours about it. But we just have to manage what we can do. So everything you cannot control, you should not at least get nervous about that. Now, I know that next month the authorities are in the US. They didn't sign anything yet. That's why the US put the tariff on it. And they will settle a deal. They will have to,
countries. So yeah, just to be clear.
You never know.
Yeah, we're in September, near the end of September, but you think there may be something in October. You're certainly not the only person.
No, I've been speaking with a few people that are very close to this kind of deals. And I've a close source that tells me that they will, 80% they will make a deal. Now, it remains a crystal ball, so I don't know. And I think LVMH was informed by Trump that there will not happening anything about tariff, and they had a tariff impact. So you never know. And Trump is also very unpredictable, of course. So, but he's right in a part also. I mean, if you look at all the business going around from the US and to Europe, I think somehow there is a truth in the middle about taxes and import duties. So we just need to settle it. That's it. And that we have to pay something, I think it's clear.
Indeed. So the U.S. is a big focus for you. It is an incredibly important market, and it has a different demand and taste profile than some other markets. Where does the U.S., you know, sit for you in terms of your distribution and your sales, and what are you doing to make more inroads in that market? Obviously, you, as you say, you know, design and the kind of product you're bringing is really important.
Yeah, you know, it's always dangerous to mention this, because then, you know, I've learned if you speak too long and too detailed about your strategy, then the competition will wake up, correct? So I will not disclose too much, but definitely pricing is key. I think choose the price range where you're strong as a brand. Don't get overwhelmed, or don't feel too confident that you can increase, because that's a dangerous move. And definitely product. And I would say the third one is, for me, the women development. They are pushing us already for multiple years in a row. We have been able to answer it. We have able to find unique launches also. But that's where the trick will take place. Have the right watch for that market. Mm. And that's where we are working on.
For sure. What have you
done? And distribution, of course. The power of having the right distribution and answering the demand, very important too.
Do you think, you know, the traditional way of selling watches, though, has changed dramatically? I mean, do your customers buy watches in different ways now?
I think where the challenge is much more retail. So, and the U.S. is not the right example, because I think the U.S. has always been that commercial drive. They always had that commercial drive, much more than, for instance, the European retail has. Where I do see a problem, and I visit regularly retail myself, if you visit a retailer and we just deliver to QP an exclusive piece, and I will ask him, hey, did you already get some traction there? No, a few people came in. I said, okay, interesting. Then I'm asking, how many people do you have in your database? Wow, 10,000 people? Okay. How many people out of the 10,000 people would buy a watch around 10,000 euro? Wow, Niels, that's maybe 2,000. Okay. How many people have an interest about something special? Wow, maybe 1,000. Okay. Why don't you take 10% of those 1,000 pieces and you just write an email? Or maybe you take 1% and you call them. He said, I have something special in my room here. I want you to offer it. I want you to see it. First come, first serve. See how it reacts. And they look at me if they see water burning. And this is the problem for me. Mm. Because the time that someone comes in and they want to buy something as a Daytona or a Submariner, we all know that's over. You need to be super proactive.
Yep.
Retail is reshaping. And you need to be super proactive to gain margin again and to gain your customer, because your customer became very knowledgeable what he wants and where he wants to buy. So if you don't offer him the way, you will never get it.
I mean, it's been a volatile year on a lot of fronts. And you talked about other brands. Obviously, the trend we've seen, especially with some of the higher end brands, is to be raising prices and taking price quite aggressively over the past few years. What have you done with pricing? And considering that you've got these new pressures like tariffs in the U.S., but also that you are a value-driven brand, and in that approachable category.
Yeah,
what have you done?
Yeah, so we didn't have that much aggressive price increase done. So we have been very careful. And I have to say, it has been a huge discussion every 6 months with my shareholding company, because supply has been going up and cost has been going up and your margin didn't go that much up. So that means your profit is under pressure. But for me, it was very important to discuss with them, guys, we are penetrating markets, we gain market share. Of course, there's a time of profit, but there's also a time of waiting and see what competition is doing and see what the market is doing. It fluctuates heavily. I think now it's the best time to say how many percentage the competition went up. And some brands went up to 40% of their prices.
Yep.
And they struggle, I can tell you. It's confirmed. They struggle with sellout. So we have been doing price increases, but much less aggressive. What positioned the brand differently than it was before. Before, we had much more competition. Today, we are quite lonely in a certain price range with a massive strategy behind well distribution, well prepared distribution worldwide. So for me, yeah, I see a huge opportunity. Now, can we manage prices that we have today? No, we also have to do, of course, price increase. And if the tariff is going to be applied or settled, we have to see how to handle it. Anyhow, if there's a tariff imposed, we have to do an increase somewhere. And all the brands are waiting because, of course, they have been so aggressive in pricing. Now they don't dare to move anymore.
Mm.
But you have to move because if there's 20% increase, anyhow, we have to do something. We cannot take the hit.
Well, yeah. I mean, we've seen initial round of increases from some of the big brands, but not too heavy. And indeed, they have the ability at the moment to wait, but they can't wait forever. And we've seen a lot of the smaller manufacturers have to pass on that tariff increase. And so how much time do you have to wait?
Well, very transparently, we have been able to discuss with the US shipments June, July. We have advanced shipments, so that helps. Then they have done an increase. We have done a global increase as of September. We prepared it already as of April when the first tariff was applied.
How much was that?
Was between 4 and 6%.
Okay.
Super marginal. Mm-hmm. We didn't increase much. Now, the US has lucky that they had stock and big shipments from us, so you can survive a few months with that. So for me, we really aim on the deal that is going to be done in October. That's key for us.
Interesting.
Or else after that, if tariff is going to stay, we have to find a solution in the US, globally, and on the chain. So we cannot just let the consumer in the US pay the bill. Mm. I don't feel that's fair. And I think many brands struggle with that because they have boutiques.
Yeah.
So if you have a brand, so for me, a watch that is 2,000 euro, if you bring them 50% up, it's still marginal in a way, I would say. It's still a lot, but it's still marginal.
Interesting. So
if you have 10,000 euro, that's another ball game. Then you can pay a ticket to Canada. You can pay a ticket to London or Paris.
Yeah.
And for us, it's still not the case. So for them, it's difficult because they have boutiques, high fixed cost. So they have to find a solution there, those brands. That's why they're getting so nervous.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about being a approachably priced brand and how that segment of the market is struggling in a way. And we see everybody else, you know, trying to premiumize and move higher and higher up the chain. You know, how do you see that market, considering where we are with so much economic uncertainty, a client, a consumer who's economically, you know, potentially nervous, how is that segment performing overall? And what do you see the future of that segment in the market?
So my segment is core is 750 to 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's my segment. That's where I belong as a watch brand. And I always say, stay true to your DNA, because if you think you are higher, you start to lose it. Because quickly going higher, we have learned, you need to have a nice complication, world timer, you need to have a QP, but you need to be able to do that to answer higher price products and demand. But our strength is 7,000 and 3,000, and that's where we should stay. Hmm. So I would say we should find alternatives on the supply and on the whole chain to constantly offer this beautiful price range instead of going up.
Yeah.
Let the competition go up.
Are you finding ways to manufacture and source supply, components, et cetera, that are allow you to keep that value proposition? Are you going elsewhere for?
No. It's becoming easier now because of the economical turnaround. So suppliers are also different again. In after COVID, it has been completely different.
Yeah.
It has been impossible to work. Today, I would say because of pressure on luxury, it gives me more opportunity to negotiate with the supplier on the pricing. But overall, it's been more expensive. We need to realize that. So you need to really have group leverage. That's where group comes back again. The group leverage you have really helps to work within a difficult time like this and use it in the right way.
For sure. And, you know, looking forward, the tariffs are the sort of immediate challenge in the U.S. and that economic uncertainty persists. But where do you, you know, want to bring the brand, say, in the next 2-3 years? I mean, you know, we've seen some quite interesting new products, sort of more, some of, a lot of it more classic in design, but, you know, recalling some great attributes of traditional watchmaking. Where do you want to bring the brand in the next little while?
Well, definitely the idea is that we are going to make more valuable products for the consumer to purchase for a very fair price. That's anyhow going to be the mission. But what we can see is that in the coming years is the idea to really innovate more on the manufacturer calibers. So I would say more aggressive in pricing. That's the aim. More specs, better value proposition. But also solar quartz, for instance, that it comes in, I'm expecting a lot from that. So it's sustainable, it has an approach, not a lot of talking around it, but very strong in terms of commercial focus, because it's exactly where we are, 1,000 to 3,000 euro with a beautiful movement solar quartz starting at around 1,200 euro, it's perfect. So there I expect a lot of volume to pick up, to continue to build volume. And then on the manufacturer, we will have anyhow beautiful exclusive launches. We have a lot of things in the pipe. And Dubai Watch Week, we're going to do another fantastic launch there. So you will see something very exclusive coming up.
Excellent. Excellent. And anything else we should be thinking about, Frédéric Constant, in the immediate term, and what's new with you and the brand and what's next?
No, I think we covered a lot. I think the people should stay tuned and follow us. And we always aim to surprise different variations of consumers, from consumers that are the first time they buy their first professional watch, serious watch. That's where they enter in the world of Frédéric Constant. And we can build them up all the way to a perpetual calendar. In the time frame of 20 years, they can take a first automatic watch. They can have a bit of a complicated automatic watch. They can go to the first manufacturer caliber with the moon phase. They can go to a perpetual calendar. So we have a retention that is quite long with the consumer. And the consumers are very happy with the brand. So let us surprise you, I would say.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. Yeah, I mean, you're creating new product to keep, you know, because you have that distribution in many places where you can be their first serious watch, and now you feel you have more and more of the products to keep them with you on their watch journey.
That's the trick. Yeah, we don't want to lose them. So at least they're fine to go one day to Patek, but let them first stop with the perpetual calendar from Frédéric Constant. That's fair enough, correct? Then they can buy 5 watches from the and we have a lot of customers that come to me, that even I have Friday, for instance, a consumer coming here, he bought a tourbillon and he really wanted to visit the factory, and he approached me. He's going to visit and I'm going to have a quick discussion with him. And he wants to see perpetual calendar tourbillon. So you can see also people are very interested about how we do it.
Yeah.
And to visit. And we are open for it. And I'm learning from that also.
Have you had to change the way, I mean, in the past, it used to be just sort of people would discover the brand when they were in a watch retailer. You've had to change the way that people hear and learn about Frédéric Constant, though. It's a different ballgame in terms of awareness and visibility.
Yeah, we have worked much more on exclusive drops in the past year, collaborations. So a little bit more outside the comfort zone of the brand. We did collaborations with watchmakers like Peter Spiet-Marin.
Mm-hmm.
We did collaborations with Second Second,
yep.
Romaric, very exclusive.
It was a cool watch.
It was super cool. Yep. And the watch is even 2 times the price now available on the market. So I've never seen that before. So that helped to create desire of the brand. And then we have worked on a lot of, I would say, YouTube content. So video content where we explain what we are doing, how we are doing it, and also those collaborations. And that really created, I would say, demand. And that really brought the brand out over the radar, where we were very often below radar volume. But with those collaborations and those YouTube content, it really helped to speak more about the brand, what we are doing, and people saw that. And then they have an interest.
Okay. Good. Well, Niels Eggelding, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to what comes next for Frédéric Constant.
Thank you, Andy.
And that's the business of watches for this episode. We hope you enjoyed. Please head on over to hodinkee.com where you can join the discussion and leave any comments or questions about this episode or the business of watches in general. Who knows, we might even answer your question on a future episode. Thanks for listening and see you next time. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh episode of The Business of Watches. Until then, I'm Andy Hoffman, and I'll see you on hodinkee.com.